Welcome back to another episode of It's a Crime, an exploration into deceit, betrayal, and the shocking truth that lies beneath.
This is episode 3 of the Anna Walsh missing persons case. I'm your host, Margaret McLean. In the last episode, Brian Walsh was arrested for misleading a police investigation. We learned that he lied to police about what he was doing right after his wife, Anna, went missing. Police recovered blood and a bloody damaged knife in the basement of their home. He also purchased a hatchet and $450 worth of heavy-duty cleaning supplies with cash. The kind of stuff that could be used to mop up a bloody crime scene, or worse, dispose of a body. So far, Anna Walsh is still missing, and police have not recovered her remains. Let's start with that. Can detectives build a first-degree murder case without a body? I'll ask Nicole Parker, a former FBI agent from the Violent Crime Squad.
You do not have to have a body in order to get a conviction. Ideally, you would like to have one, of course. I mean, that's very powerful evidence, but it is absolutely not necessary.
This is a case that police are going to have to build from circumstantial evidence. And in this episode, we will explore exactly how they'll do it. But before we get into that, remember how we ended last episode by discussing Brian's big smile when he got arrested? I wondered what that was all about. So I reached out to a professional, Dr. Tina Adams, who has a PhD in clinical psychology and was clinical director at the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families in Worcester. Dr. Adams calls it duper's delight.
He's essentially achieved his goal. I have pulled the wool over the eyes of whomever, and I have fooled them.
Perhaps Brian is thinking he fooled investigators by getting rid of his wife's body. Dr. Adams told me that Brian may not have even realized he was smiling in front of all those cameras. It may be an internal manifestation of duper's delight. It's his way of thinking that he's manipulated and controlled the situation. Serial killer Ted Bundy was also famous for his duper's delight smile, and he killed over 30 women in the 1970s. If you look at old footage, you'll see exactly what I mean. Brian might be thinking he duped the police, but he actually made it easier for them by throwing trash bags into dumpsters, bringing his phone with him, and getting caught on camera. These dumpsters are located in Abington and Swampscott, and they become crucial in the investigation. Let's focus on one dumpster at a time. On January 2nd, before anyone knew that Anna was missing, cameras show Brian pulling up to the dumpster in Abington in his Volvo, getting out and grabbing a big, heavy-looking garbage bag and using all his might to heft it into that dumpster. He then throws two additional bags in and drives away. This dumpster is located about 35 to 40 minutes from his home. By the time the police see the footage, they know they have to scramble because garbage from that dumpster goes to Wareham to the CMAS facility to be burned. This is Prosecutor Greg Connor explaining what the police found when searching for the contents of that dumpster.
By January 8th, Your Honor, all of the dumpsters that police could identify that Mr. Walsh had gone to, with the exception of going to the Swampscott dumpster on the 5th, had been emptied and taken to CMAS. CMAS is a large-scale waste-to-energy recycling facility where the contents of the dumpsters are shredded and incinerated. This process goes on 24 hours a day, and by that time, by the 8th, all of those contents had been incinerated, leaving behind only a fine ash.
Unfortunately, we'll never know what Brian threw into that dumpster. Police speculate that it was Anna's remains. Luckily, the contents of the dumpster located in Swampscott next to Brian's mother's home was not destroyed. It was brought to a transfer station in Peabody to be searched. So how do they go through all that garbage looking for evidence?
So they get into their hazmat suits, they go into the scene, and they're looking for evidence. There is a theory called Locard's exchange principle.
That's retired State Police Captain Paul Zipper, who teaches CSI. So he's referring to Dr. Edmund Locard, a forensic pioneer from the early 1900s known as the Sherlock Holmes of France. His exchange theory means when you commit a crime, you will bring something into that crime scene and leave with something from it.
Nothing in, nothing out.
Nothing in means investigators don't leave their houses in the morning, pat their dogs, go to Dunk's, eat powdered donuts, then enter a crime scene and gather evidence.
They are leaving behind their own DNA, hair fibers, skin cells, blood, body fluids.
That's right. Every contact within a crime scene leaves a trace which can end up being key forensic evidence. That's why the crime scene must be preserved at all costs.
Safety people during some of these cases touched things and didn't want to admit that they did that.
A good defense attorney would be all over it. Hey, they got the wrong guy. This isn't my client's DNA. Somebody else committed this crime. The evidence speaks for itself.
Forensic evidence doesn't lie.
It will be very time-consuming for investigators to go through the contents of that Swampscott dumpster. Let's fast forward and see what they found. This is what Greg Connor informed the court.
In the Swampscott dumpster, they found items, including a set of Volkswagen keys, Anna Walsh's COVID vaccination card, an Hermes watch identical to what Anna Walsh was known to wear, blue-gray hunter boots, a black Prada purse, and a short black coat.
That's pretty much the same description that Brian told Cohasset police when they were first searching for Anna, that she'd be dressed in a short black coat, hunter boots, Prada bag, Hermes watch, and that she'd be carrying the same overnight bag. Coincidentally, those things ended up in a dumpster, and that's not all.
Also located in the dumpster, Your Honor, were rugs consistent with those that were in the living room and the kitchen of the Cohasset home. These rugs contain red-brown staining as well, and a piece of a Gucci necklace consistent with one that Anna Walsh wore was found within one of the two rugs.
Brian also did some emergency shopping at Lowe's, and that stuff ended up in the dumpster too.
The dumpster contained numerous items identical to those that Mr. Walsh had purchased at Lowe's, which included a Tyvek suit, a Lennox high-tension hacksaw, hammer, hatchet, and snips. The Tyvek suit had a red-brown stain on the exterior. The stain was tested, and Anna Walsh was determined to be a contributor.
This is a lot to take in. Hacksaws, blood-stained rugs from their house, blood-stained Tyvek suit with Anna's DNA on it, Anna's clothes, accessories, and the keys to her car. My friends and neighbors are shocked. Let's turn to former Special Agent Nicole Parker and see what she has to say.
For a small town to be hit with something like this, I mean, that tragedy would be devastating. It's devastated the entire country. A small town, it is going to rock that town completely.
At what point did that good old boy, handsome guy next door become a potential murderer? Let's turn the clock back and analyze Brian's early childhood with Dr. Tina Adams.
What we know from research, the early experiences of a child, the more negative they are, the more adverse the prognosis for their development and their future.
I'd like to know what Brian's childhood was really like. How did that impact his adult years and especially his relationship with Anna and their children? I wanted to understand for myself, and I did some research and found a very close friend of Anna's on Facebook. Her name is Pam. I reached out and she agreed to meet with me. We had a very nice lunch together and talked about Anna. We also talked about Brian, their relationship, and their children. The two families were very close. What I learned that day is both enlightening and heartbreaking. Brian did have a dysfunctional childhood, and Anna knew about it. She tried to be a positive influence in his life. Brian's mother, Diana, was aloof and cold and not a very nurturing mother. Brian's father, Dr. Thomas Moorcroft Walsh III, was a prominent neurologist. He was pretty much the same way. I mean, cold, not loving, very critical of Brian as a child, also physically and emotionally abusive. Remember, Brian didn't have any siblings to lean on either. In a letter to the judge for federal court, Anna said, Brian was told he was a loser, that his parents should not have had him, that he had no chances of making anything of himself in life, and that he was a lost cause. Dr. Adams explained that for children, family life and the relationship to their parents is foundational, meaning it's how they learn to engage in the world and what to expect in life.
For Brian, it sounds like home life was unstable, was harsh, was neglectful. It's possible that it was abusive in terms of physical abuse, certainly emotional abuse, at the very least.
Brian was also shipped off to boarding school at a young age.
His parents experienced him as a problem. They were essentially ridding themselves of the problem and letting someone else take care of him and solve their problem.
I also obtained records from federal court which shed a light on Brian's childhood. According to the affidavit of Dr. Jeffrey Ornstein, Brian's father left the family when Brian was young, and he goes on to describe the family situation as severely dysfunctional and a hostile environment.
We do know that he's had a mental health crisis at the college age.
Yes, Brian left Carnegie Mellon and became a long-term patient at the Austin Riggs Center, which is a psychiatric hospital. Dr. Ornstein described him as a sociopath. And that's basically somebody with an antisocial personality disorder who's extremely selfish, dishonest, and exhibits a disregard for others.
It speaks to his potentially feeling very isolated and not having any positive attachments.
Brian's attachment issues continued to deteriorate, especially with his father. Over the years, Brian became estranged with his dad, who left the family to seek an alternative lifestyle. Dr. Walsh later accused Brian of stealing, and there was a severe falling out. When Dr. Walsh died a few years ago, his will read, quote, I hereby bequeath to Brian R. Walsh my best wishes, but nothing else from my estate. Of course, Brian allegedly destroyed that will, and then was sued by relatives in probate court for liquidating assets in the estate, including more than $100,000 in bank funds, valuables, a car, and very expensive pieces of art. Speaking of Brian's love for money, I find it very interesting that Anna had a significant life insurance policy, and who do you think she named as sole beneficiary in the event of her death? Here's Prosecutor Greg Connor again.
Also in the investigation, it was determined that in 2001, Anna Walsh had taken out approximately $2.2 million in life insurance on herself, where Brian Walsh is the sole beneficiary. And as a result of working at Tishman Speyer, she has an additional more than $400,000 life insurance policy where he was the sole beneficiary. In total, her life insurance is over $2.7 million where the defendant was the sole beneficiary.
That's a lot of money. It could be a motive for murder. But was Brian that deranged that he'd butcher the mother of his children? I think there's a lot more to discover about Brian Walsh. The next episode will be explosive. We'll discuss Brian's further unraveling and why Anna stayed with him for as long as she did. There's also a mysterious note that Anna wrote to Brian right before she was murdered. You'll learn about a possible affair, a private investigator, a bone fragment, more blood, and a real look inside the mind of a sociopathic killer. It's about to become as dark as it gets. This is Margaret McLean. Thank you for listening to It's a Crime.